I'm Scott Detrow. There's so much political news to follow these days, but you don't have to keep up with all of it. You just have to keep up with us on the NPR Politics podcast. With a team of NPR political reporters and editors, we record two episodes a week and sometimes more when the big news happens. Find the NPR Politics podcast on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, Glenn Weldon.
Hey, Stephen Thompson.
Glenn, you have got to be pleased that we are gathered here today to talk Blade Runner. You're a big Blade Runner guy, right?
I am. In fact, when I just showed that movie to our own Linda Holmes a couple weeks back, I made it all the way through without mouthing along with the dialogue, which I am taking as a victory because I really, really could have.
I believe that. Now, the original 1982 film starred Harrison Ford and was directed by Ridley Scott. The movie has developed a huge cult following, so it's not a surprise that we are getting a sequel, even though it is 35 years later.
So now we have Blade Runner 2049. The sequel is directed by Denis Villeneuve and stars Ryan Gosling as a man who hunts down and kills replicants, which is what these movies called bioengineered humans, who were manufactured as slave labor but came to be viewed as a security threat. And as we've seen from the trailers, this one's got Harrison Ford too.
So we've got chilling visions of the future and also Ryan Gosling on this episode of Pop Culture Happy Hour. But before we get started, let's introduce our other panelist, writer Chris Klimek. Hello, Chris.
Hey, Stephen.
It's good to have you here, buddy. Now, we saw Blade Runner 2049 with our pal Linda Holmes, but she is sick in bed and unable to join us this week. But I've still got a pair of Blade Runner superfans at my disposal, and I'm going to start with you, Glenn. What did you think of this movie?
I dug it. It might be my favorite film I've seen so far this year. What I like about it is something that Chris mentioned in his review for NPR. It engages with the themes of the original film, but it doesn't feel like a retread. It feels like an expansion. Mm-hmm. Watching this film, I got the sense that the universe of that original film has grown and gotten wider. When the opening text came on, I'll be honest, I was worried because there's a lot of information packed into that stuff, and I was getting trade Federation flashbacks, you know, from Star Wars. But you do feel the length of this film. I think you can't not.
It's 2 hours and 43 minutes.
Yeah. So NPR's Chris Klimek said it felt shorter than the original.
Yeah, I know you did.
but that guy.
I think it's still a good idea to regulate your fluid intake before this film. But I really, really dug it. I'm missing something of the weirdness that Rutger Hauer brought to the first one.
There's
just a level of crazy that this film doesn't have, but it's got so many other things going for it. I really loved it.
Thank you, Glenn. Chris, what do you think?
Yeah, I'm just so happy. I mean, I never thought there would be a sequel to Blade Runner. I never thought there should be a sequel to Blade Runner. Obviously, it's a movie that left tons of story on the table. There's all these references to what's happening on the off-world colonies, and Rutger Hauer has this famous monologue at the end that he apparently largely wrote himself about.
This is the one about the kick murder squads?
That's earlier.
That's earlier.
That's in the briefing scene. That's in the briefing exposition at the beginning of the movie. No, this is as Rutger Hauer's Roy Batty is dying.
Right.
And he's giving this the tears and rains. Which apparently he mostly wrote himself, but he refers to watching sea beams off the shoulder of, you know, attack ships on fire off the shoulder of Orion and sea beams glittering in the Tannhauser Gate. And I mean, I have seen this movie 400 times. I don't know what those things are.
Yep.
And I was so afraid that this movie was going to midichlorian it up and tell us exactly what all that stuff is. And it doesn't. It doesn't, you know, like I said in the review, it just expands the world. It doesn't go back and just like revisit all the old stuff. And it also kind of does away with the film noir element of the first one. Like it's not trying to sandwich all of its ideas about artificial intelligence and, you know, what we owe our creations that can think and feel into this framework of a genre that was already 40 years old at the time of the original film. So I loved it.
I liked it too, and I'm not necessarily somebody who was sitting there clinging to the notion that one day there might be a Blade Runner sequel. I'd watched it as a kid and then rewatched it for the first time in 30 plus years the day before this screening so that it would be fresher in my memory. And I remember watching the first one and thinking, gosh, I hope they keep this kind of meditative quality of the first one. The first one is a science fiction movie, but it's not an action movie.
Yeah.
Not at all.
And I was really afraid that this was going to be, even though Arrival, which Denis Villeneuve did last year, is one of my favorite movies, period.
Mm-hmm.
So I trusted that he would get this, but I was still afraid that there was going to be this element of kind of rote action. And this movie doesn't have that. I think it's got some third act problems where you're going from this meditative look at this world. All this world building is so interesting, and the ideas about what the world would be like in 2049 are so interesting. once they have to kind of dispense with the plot a little bit, I gotta say I lost a little bit of interest in the end. I felt some real third act problems with this movie, mostly because I was so in love with all the scene setting.
Yeah.
There was a very much a ruminative quality yes, to this word. Film.
I mean, are there moments when we get a really tight shot of Ryan Gosling's face because he's just had some kind of insight and we hold for a long time and the soundtrack is going, boom. Yes, there's lots of those. I mean, that's Villeneuve. I knew that was coming. I figured that was going to be part of this. But my thing is, with the plot, which I liked, there are a lot of twists and turns and red herrings.
Right.
And I'm wondering, clocking in at 2 hours and 43 minutes long, if the second time I see this, and the third, and the fourth, and the fifth, if I'm going to be impatient, you know? Because there's a difference between being kind of lulled along by this story and all these amazing visuals, and now I know what's going to come, and when I'm off on a kind of a sidetrack, I'm wondering if there's going to be enough there to kind of keep me interested.
It seems like the number one knock that I hear about the original Blade Runner is that there is not enough story there. As you pointed out, like, it is a contemplatively paced film, and this one does kick the pace up. It feels more Christopher Nolan than Ridley Scott to me, and I don't mean to dismiss Denis Villeneuve, because in Sicario, Arrival, and this, he's made three good to great movies in 3 years, and Villeneuve has become one of my favorite filmmakers in a very short amount of time. But yeah, there is a lot more story beats in this, so they kind of have to accelerate the pace. It wasn't too jarring for me, but it is notable.
Sure, I mean, I get that completely. I just found, like, ideas greater than greater than greater than action. So another thing that I really dug about this movie is the movie seems to extrapolate from 1982's vision of the late aughts instead of the late aughts vision of the late aughts. And I think that is really important. I mean, the original Blade Runner has got your flying cars. Yep. Yeah. It's all neon and steam.
Right. And let's talk about those neon logos for Pan Am and Atari and all these corporations that don't exist anymore, but they're still there in the new movie. And I just love that it commits to that. It doesn't try to go back and revise predictions that turned out to be wrong. Because, I mean, that's not really what sci-fi is about. Sci-fi is always about when it was written, when it was created. It's never about when it's set.
But also, science fiction is usually making some commentary on the present, right? So you have a lot of commentary burbling under the surface about environmental catastrophe, about the exploitation of women, and about virtual reality. I mean, I felt lots of the undercurrents of the movie Her, a movie that I love and Glenn does not.
I'm on your side on that one.
Thank you. What I love about Her is also being... This is also marinating in that same soup of ideas. What did you guys make of this film's vision of the future?
Well, it's kind of a reset from the world that we got before. I mean, there's this I don't think it's giving too much away to say that we're told that in the intervening 30 years, and this movie, 30 years have elapsed since the first film as well, that there was this event called the blackout, some kind of an electromagnetic pulse that erased all the data records and everything. So much of the world, much of the Western world was kind of back to square one. This is kind of the future that I think we're getting, that we're going to set ourselves up for. I mean, I love Star Trek. I want to believe in the optimistic Star Trek future. I see no evidence that it's going to turn out that way. But, you know, like Fox Mulder, I want to believe.
So do people need to have seen the 1982 Blade Runner to appreciate this movie? That's, I feel like, a question a lot of people have going into this.
I would say yes. I mean, I think this works on a level that is commenting on that first film, and the what's going on in science fiction outside of the film is informing this. The technology of today is informing this, enriching it, making it, as I say, a more expansive experience. And there are certain questions at the center of this film which are raised in the first, and it doesn't feel like just a direct, like, franchise sequel. It does feel like a commentary on that first film in a way that I think you really need to see the first film.
Yeah, and I would never deign to speak for Linda Holmes, but when we were driving back from the theater, one thing that Linda said about whether you should have seen it is, she's like, I'm not sure that you necessarily need it to follow this movie, but you might need it to care about this movie.
Right.
That some of the emotional stakes in this movie mean a lot more in the context of the first movie.
Yeah. I mean, that's interesting. I was going to say, I don't think it's completely necessary. I mean, clearly it's a richer experience if you've seen the first movie, and obviously you're much keener for this one if you were enthusiastic about the first one. But I mean, I think it really is like, you know, Terminator 2, like The Dark Knight. And I mean, of course, I'm choosing these, you know, sequels that I consider to be complete artistic successes. deliberately, in that I think they do stand alone. They are a richer experience if they're experienced in a continuum. Also, Harrison Ford in this movie, I think he is much more emotionally invested in his performance here than he was the first time around.
He
famously didn't want to do the voiceover that appears in the original theatrical release of Blade Runner that's taken out of the final cut. I just think he's more fully present here. And again, like I was saying to Glenn before we went on air here, like some of the limitations in the performances in the original film kind of work in the broader scope of what the movie is doing. But I think Harrison Ford gives a better, richer performance in this movie, and I think he cares about it more.
Yeah, he showed up in a way that he hasn't in a while. He's delivering a performance that's actually surprised me because I'm used to him giving an attitude.
Right.
He's really fully invested, as Chris mentions. The other thing that we should mention to people who are concerned about this film is that Jared Leto isn't in it very much. Not as much as you are afraid he will be, and what he does very precisely, and then gets the hell off the screen.
I like that his building, his headquarters in this movie, it looks like there's water being refracted through light wherever you go in every direction, and it kind of keeps you thinking that, life began in the seas. But elsewhere in the building, it just seems like we're getting that rippling water effect everywhere with no obvious source. I just thought it was a cool visual detail.
There are a lot of cool visual details, and I do think this is a movie that people will benefit from springing. If you are a Blade Runner person, you will benefit from springing for the largest screen. We saw it in like Vibrovision.
That was a little silly.
Where like the seats actually vibrated.
I'm the only one who likes getting a headache from a movie.
But I do think that it benefits from being that gigantic visual experience.
Yeah. Midway through this film, I forgot that there's no such thing as flying cars and that all that was special effects, just because it is so well integrated into the everyday. It just feels like a thing that happens. It doesn't feel like a zappy space pilot thing. It's just flying cars. We got
There is not one shot in this movie where I looked at CGI and was like, oh, that's bad CGI. Like everything that's a little spectral is supposed to look that way. It is perfectly, just like seamlessly integrated. And if cinematographer Roger Deakins does not get his Oscar for this movie, then he's never getting it.
Yeah.
I mean, he's been nominated a bunch of times. I don't think he's ever won, but it looks spectacular.
Yeah, that would be a sign that there is an actual conspiracy. Yeah. I mean, Dunkirk is a great looking movie too.
He's gonna have some competition.
Yeah, I mean, I think there are certain scenes in this movie that rise so far above. Like, my favorite scene in this movie is this incredible sequence involving a woman who creates artificial memories, and almost like creating dreams. And it is such a gorgeous, gorgeous scene that even if it were just that, I would recommend this movie on that basis alone. Mm-hmm. Something else we should note, again, to bring up one of the points that Linda made, I think once this movie is out and some of its plot points are discussed in more detail, we're really trying to avoid all spoilers here. Some of the violence against women in this movie is a little unnerving. And I think that as the discussion around this movie evolves, I think that's something that will come up more and more. If that is something that you especially don't like to see in movies, it's worth noting that this has a couple. I mean, you have this incredible visual stylist. There are a lot of searing images in this movie. There are a couple of disturbing ones.
I mean, it's on brand. You know, there's disturbing violence in this movie, and it's on brand.
I think the biggest takeaway is if you love Blade Runner, if you have been itching for a Blade Runner sequel for 35 years, this is going to scratch that itch, I think, in a big, big way. So we want to know what you think of Blade Runner 2049. Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or tweet us at PCHH. When we come back, it'll be time for our favorite segment of this week and every week, What's Making Us Happy?
Support for this NPR podcast and the following message come from ABC. With Marvel's Inhumans, where on the dark side of the moon exists a civilization of Inhumans, with two brothers battling for one throne. Experience the first chapter of this new saga now in IMAX theaters. Get tickets now at beinhumaninimax.com and watch the complete series on ABC, Fridays starting September 29th. Marvel's Inhumans. Support for Pop Culture Happy Hour comes from Boomerang, a premium video subscription service offering timeless cartoons and new original animated series. All month long, Boomerang is celebrating Halloween by spotlighting spooky and hilarious animation during Scoobtober. Join Scooby-Doo and the gang as they solve mysteries about monsters. Plus, watch episodes, movies, and Halloween specials of Dorothy and the Wizard of Oz, Courage the Cowardly Dog, Bunicula, and more. Scream and stream your favorite classic and contemporary cartoons all Scoobtober long with Boomerang. You can find Boomerang on web, mobile, Apple TV, Amazon Fire, Roku, and Chromecast. Visit boomerang.com/promo and use the promo code HAPPY to start your free trial today.
Welcome back. It is time for our favorite segment, What is Making Us Happy This Week, Glenn? What's making you happy this week, buddy?
Handsome Devil is a coming-of-age Irish film that came out last year. It's written and directed by John Butler. It's about a loner kid who is at a boarding school that is entirely devoted to rugby. And he doesn't hate rugby. He's just perfectly ambivalent about it, which makes him the focus of a lot of bullying. He gets a new roommate who is a rugby star, and the film progresses in ways you probably won't see coming. And it's kind of buoyed by this performance by Fionn O'Shea as Ned, one of the kid who gets bullied, because he's keeping it light. This has the potential to go in a after-school special direction at any moment, and it never does because he has this sardonic resilience in the face of the bullying, and he's just a really great young actor. And this film also features a performance by Andrew Scott, who plays Moriarty in Sherlock, mm-hmm. who is known for going big and
yep.
chewy. And he kind of modulates it here. He plays a teacher, and there is a scene in this film that takes place on a rugby pitch at night between Andrew Scott's teacher and the other kid, the rugby star kid played named Connor, which is so searingly real and just heartbreaking that if the rest of the film sucked, which it doesn't, I would still recommend for that moment, which is just really available, emotionally available. So that's Handsome Devil. It's available streaming all over the place.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Glenn Weldon. Chris Klimek, what's making you happy this week?
Well, there's a new Star Trek series, and I haven't seen it yet, so I have to stay in the dystopian future. Sorry. And recommend Omar al-Akkad's debut novel, which is called American War. Mr. Akkad is a journalist born in Cairo who now lives in Canada. He's reported from Afghanistan and other conflict zones. This is his first novel, and it is a future history of the Second Civil War in the United States, which happens in the back half of the 21st century. The novel's kind of like the postscript at the end of The Handmaid's Tale, which is a book I thought about a lot while I was reading it, where we get the people of the far future reflecting back from a symposium on Galadian studies about how this whole terrible regime ran its course in the distant past. In this one, the Union fractures over fossil fuel prohibition. The blue states ban fossil fuels. The red states don't like it. They fight all of the tools of modern war, bioweapons, drones, everything awful is employed. The novel is from the point of view of a woman of color. Her name is Surat Chestnut. She is 6 years old at the beginning of the novel, and it kind of follows her journey of radicalization, how this pure, innocent child who just wants to experience life is turned into a remorseless soldier. This is not a happy book.
I was going to say, this sounds
fun. But it is a brilliantly written book. I found all the details of this future world, this dystopia, sadly credible, compelling. It is a fantastic novel. Not going to pick you up, but it's called American War by Omar al-Akkad.
Thank you, Chris Klimek. Sounds like a blast.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I brought something a little lighter. I brought an article from The New Yorker by a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful writer named Gia Tolentino. Mm-hmm. It just made my heart smile through and through. It's called The Repressive Authoritarian Soul of Thomas the Tank Engine and Friends.
Yep.
She is certainly not the first person to point out the fascist undertones of Thomas the Tank Engine and Friends, but it's got a bunch of wonderful, quotable writing. Just little asides, like she talks about Sir Topham Hatt, the railway director, and describes him as, he looks like Monopoly's rich uncle Pennybags, but with eyes that have almost surely witnessed murder. she explains, she's sort of explaining how there's this whole corner of the internet where people view and explain Thomas the Tank Engine as, and I quote, a depiction of a pre-modern corporate totalitarian dystopia. and explains in incredibly vivid and beautifully written detail just how kind of terrifying this show's vision of the world is, where any worker who steps out of line is like walled up in a tunnel. It's a beautiful little piece of writing. It's not a long read, and I kind of wish it were, but it's so fun. I urge everyone to check it out. You will get a big laugh. It's called The Repressive Authoritarian Soul of Thomas the Tank Engine and Friends by Gia Tolentino in The New Yorker. And that brings us to the end of the show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can find me at I Dislike Steven. You can find Glenn at G.H. Weldon. And you can find Chris at C.T. Klimek. That's C-T-K-L-I-M-E-K. You can find our producer Jessica at Jessica_Reedy. And our producer emeritus Mike Katziff at Mike Katziff. That's K-A-T-Z-I-F. Mike's band Hello Come In provides our theme music, which you are bobbing your head to right now. Also, if you like the show, please leave a review on Apple Podcasts. It really helps new listeners discover the show. And that brings us to the end of this episode of Pop Culture Happy Hour. Thanks so much to you both for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you, Stephen. Feel better, Linda.
And we will see you right back here next week.